So tonight, I'm going to use a logic that's used a lot by Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, which is called not one and not two. Chikdudral, it's called in Tibetan. Not one and not two. And this logic points out that things don't come together, nor do they separate. They don't come together, nor do they separate. So this is a special logic for me personally, because this is the first logic I ever learned from my teacher Zigar Khongtrul Rinpoche when I was very young, and we had just known each other for a very short time, and we went on kind of a little vacation together, and I remember sitting, we were in outside of Kathmandu in a little village, and we were sitting on a hill, and we were very young, we were just like children in some way, maybe. He was 21 and I was 23 at that time. And I was just beginning to study the Dharma. And Rinpoche introduced me to this logic by holding up two fingers like this. So take, for people who are just listening maybe to the tape, I'm holding up both my pointer fingers, and they're both touching, so creating kind of a triangle but with no base. So two pointer fingers touching. So he asked me, is this one? Or is this two? And I thought, well, there's two fingers, and yet it's creating one shape, I guess what you would say, one shape. So then I thought, well, maybe it's not one or two. So he was very happy with my answer. It pretty much took me 10 years to realize what that had anything to do with spiritual awakening. So I want to talk about that. That's my challenge today, to try to explain, describe what this has to do with spiritual awakening, which is not an easy task. Let's see if I can do it. So we've talked, so the past two nights, we've talked about how everything is made of relationship. So if everything's made of relationship, we actually can't talk about two separate things coming together and parting. So this is getting at that to some degree. Where is this one separate thing that has a relationship with this other separate thing? When we start to look, of course, there is no separate thing. Everything's in relationship. And again, our mantra has been, we added on a second sentence to our mantra yesterday. So the full mantra is, because things are in relationship, they are empty, right? Mm-hmm. Then the second part is, because of emptiness, everything can arise and appear. Without emptiness, things would be inert. So without emptiness, we couldn't experience the world of appearances and possibilities. So this is, again, this is still going to continue to be our kind of our mantra. I was saying today, speaking with Gina and Rebecca, we were speaking at lunch, and Kiki and Julia and Donna, we were speaking about how... it's very important to be able to explain what emptiness is, actually, to be very clear, mm-hmm. and to continue to, it's not, you know, I always say, it's not how the Dharma is just, not just how the Dharma is explained to you, but also how you explain it to yourself. Mm-hmm. And since our understanding and our world keeps changing and our studies keep evolving, we make continuous adjustments with language. Language is something to continuously adjust. There's no determinate word for anything. Words change over time, and they mean different things in different contexts. So, you know, it's not enough to just kind of know what emptiness is. I think it's very important for us of this tradition, particularly a Vajrayana tradition, to know what emptiness is, because you can't know the nature of the deity if you don't understand emptiness. If we don't know emptiness, the deity will be like it is in any other theistic tradition, just something to believe in, like a thing, a real something that's real, but perhaps pure, and then, of course, we are the impure ones. Whereas that's not what this is saying. Actually, the nature of the deity is emptiness, and the nature of a piece of paper is emptiness. So everything is equal in its emptiness and its purity, therefore. So there, this is why emptiness is, this understanding is so important, and how important it is to articulate it and to work toward understanding it and through words. I think this is very important for us. So we've been able to see that these so-called things have no boundary, no intrinsic boundary. So they're empty of intrinsic existence. So in a manner of speaking, we might say that things from the very smallest particle, we talked about atoms or God particles yesterday, to a grosser thing like a rock or an enormous mountain, don't exist as separate or isolated. They're not autonomous. They exist in relationship, and they're compounded. As we went through all those words. Compound. They're not compounded. They're not. They're compounded. They're not autonomous. We talked about intrinsic and singular, and all these things that they're not. So we went over that yesterday. So everything in a certain way we can say is made of relationship, infinite relationship. Like there's no end to how it can be broken down and seen to be in relationship. But then we have to be very careful here. We have to be careful here because we might think that relationship is something real or intrinsic. So this is what I'm going to talk about here. We might think that, for example, relationship talks of all these threads that we weave together and that it makes the fabric of our world. So that we talked about the sun and the air and the logger and the wood and so forth. These are all these different things that create, like building blocks that create this fabric of what seems very real to us. So today I want to investigate what we mean when we say the word relationship. We need to do an examination. We need to investigate relationship in the same way we had to examine existence. We assume we know what relationship is, but actually have we ever looked into it carefully? Do we actually even see relationship? This is the question here. What does it mean to be in relationship? So again, you know, this path really forces us or pushes us into examining language, because our beliefs actually are held in place by our language. Mm-hmm. We use the word belief or faith or real or true or self. What does this mean? And the words, we kind of impute a meaning onto something, but actually when we look more deeply, what do we find there? And what do we actually mean when we say the word relationship? So there's this constant adjusting that needs to happen. So we have this discussion in this tradition, we're using words and logics to open it up. Again, as we were saying, move out of abstraction and start to see what's really there. So it's a dynamic process of illumination, language. Language, so this is what's very interesting. Language can obscure. We self, 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 we use self, we assume everybody knows what self is or what real is. That's, you know, that's how language can actually lock us in a way that we're not opening and examining our life. But language, we can also use language to illuminate, like we're trying to do here, like we do in our tradition. So languages, it can go either way, but it's such a fabulous, amazing gift that we have. If we understand that it's not a determinate structure, there's nothing true about language. It's just a skillful means or a method or kind of a tool that we have. So the investigation not the same or separate, maybe we can call this, not the same or separate, has to do with relationship, and it calls into question whether or not things in relationship come together or separate. So why is this important first? Very important to ask this question. Why would we study such a logic? So we need to go back to the human conundrum, the human predicament that we talked about yesterday. And the predicament is that we feel like we exist. And feeling like we exist, we're in this constant state of trying to survive. Remember we talked about it? Mm-hmm. Continuous survival is one of the definitions in the dictionary of existence. So because of this, we're so focused on our continuous survival. And we talked about how painful it is to just live a life based on wanting to survive, protecting and maintaining this sense of self that we think is so true. And this is what we call samsara, this grasping onto. So with this desire to continue surviving comes, of course, this fear of extinction. You know, not wanting to not exist and holding on very tightly in this strong state of contraction. So like I was saying yesterday, you know, we tend to see ourself in relationship, but ourself in relationship to us usually is all this grasping and rejection and wanting and not wanting. So we're always cherishing ourselves with and protecting ourselves from relationship. So this is our activity, and we see it in our practice as well. When we sit to practice, we just don't even know really what to do with our experience. We don't know what to do with it. We get overwhelmed. We try to escape it. We push it away. We brace ourselves against it, the whole bit. So even though we struggle in relationship, relationship is very important to us. We actually use relationship to affirm our existence. You know we exist because we are in relationship with the world. We don't want to lose that relationship to our world. It helps us understand that we exist, or at least that's how we think and feel about it all the time. So when our relationship to this life and this body is severed, we say we no longer exist. We're dead, you know. Mm-hmm. So actually, the fear in some ways is not even this idea of existence, but this idea of separation or loss. Losing, the sadness of losing. So dying means we have to leave this world behind, and we have an idea of what we're leaving, our body, our beloved family and friends, and this world that we're so familiar with. So we want to stay in relationship with those we love. We want to stay in relationship to what's familiar to us. We don't want to separate, and we struggle with this, and we struggle with this feeling of loneliness, in separation, even while we're alive, very much so, and not wanting to be away from those that we love. And I find that this particular logic actually gets to the real emotional core, you know, of our this kind of dilemma or predicament we have with existence. Because, yeah, thinking of leaving is one thing, but this feeling of separating and loss, that's, I think, that even describes the pain of it more to me. I don't know how it is for you. I'd be curious to hear. So I was asking myself, as I contemplated this logic, can we actually say what it means to be with somebody as opposed to separate? That's a very interesting question. What does it mean to be with someone? You know, we don't necessarily have to be in close physical proximity to feel that we're with someone. And sometimes we're physically close to someone, but we feel extremely distant. And sometimes with someone with, you know, people we're intimate with, being with someone, it's like we want to be more intimate, like we feel so unfulfilled, almost like we're wanting to merge, you know, in that way. Because we can't find our connection. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think everybody somewhat probably knows what this means. Yeah, we want to feel a kind of a distance, or we want to feel that fulfillment in relationship. And there's kind of a lack of contentment. So we're always looking for this sense of connection, you know, to things. So, you know, people often feel this with a teacher, for example, you know, with our guru. Sometimes we feel we don't even know how to be in relationship with the guru. It's so uncomfortable at times. I don't know if it's that way with Drung Rumshe or not. But sometimes I've felt when I've been around my teachers this sense of not quite knowing how I am in relationship to them, or feeling I wish to be closer, or they feel so far away. Or I know a lot of people have this problem. People talk about it. Constantly, and I hear it like on my blog and so forth, just trying to figure this all out, how to be with the teacher, how to be connected. Some people have close, intimate relationships with the teacher. Some people have relationships with teacher from the distance, and it's fine, and other people feel a lack in that distance and so forth. So the middle way in the middle way teachings, we start by questioning the way we ordinarily look at relationship. Ordinarily, without questioning, in other words. And the way we ordinarily look is we have these two options of either being together or separate. So we can talk about interpersonal relationships in this context in terms of separate and apart. But we can also talk about objects. This is very interesting, and this is done a lot in the traditional Majjhimaka path. For example, in the tradition, we often talk about seed and sprout. I think I mentioned that. Mm-hmm. Seed and sprout. So these are two objects. Do they ever come together and separate? This is something that comes up a lot. So when we look deeply, we start to see that togetherness and separation is a misunderstanding that comes from these two views, these two, another dualism, and another not middle way, two extremes, two misunderstandings. And whenever we feel stuck in this kind of dualism, we need to bring our confusion into the middle way and understand how to find another way of understanding things. This is what I love about having studied the middle way some, is that whenever I feel conflicted or in a dualistic situation, I can always put that situation into this logic mm-hmm. and find another way of doing something. Mm-hmm. It is really, really something. And it's like a way I find to be creative. I'm always looking for the middle way of everything. Any kind of conflict that I have, it comes like a game in a sense, but it's also extremely, it informs your actions. Mm-hmm. It informs your actions and it gives you a different way, a different perspective. So even intellectually, this is very helpful, I find. So, the more you get into this, you'll start to see So are together and separate the only ways of being in relationship? Well, are they? This maybe has something to do with this triangle that Rinpoche was this kind of mudra that Rinpoche showed me. So the middle way, again, asks us to look at our views and question if relationship is truly an existing thing. People expressed, how this term made of relationship brings so much warmth. People love when I use instead of interdependence. They like the word relationship because there's this warmth. There's this connection. So, when I start to talk a little bit about how actually you can never see or locate anything meeting or separating, people kind of sometimes get disappointed and feel ripped off or something, but don't worry, again, there's never rejection in this tradition. You don't have to reject experience or relationship. There is no falling into an abyss of any kind. So this is a bit of a contemplation maybe we can do, just to contemplate while I say these things. A powerful question came to my mind. Is something we ever see in our experience? Do we ever see relationship? So I'm going to ask you these questions. I'm going to give some examples. And just try, you'll get a sense of what I'm saying, and you'll try to look for something. So the first one is, for instance, can we point to where the shoulder becomes the arm? Mm-hmm. Can we locate this place where the shoulder becomes the arm? Can we really find it, that line? Number two. At what point does an infant become a toddler? Mm-hmm. Or a toddler become a child? Or a child become a teenager? Or a teenager become an adult? So many of you must be parents here mm-hmm. and must know this experience. Where is this defining moment where you say, oh, my son has become a man? We often see our son and it occurs to us, oh, my son is now a man. But when did that happen? When did that happen? Where was that defining moment? When did that take place? Can you find that? Can you find that in your own growing up? And the next one is, when we talk about seed and sprout, do we ever really see the moment when the seed becomes a sprout? Do we see that ever? Even on a slow motion video, can we actually locate that? And when we look into the mirror, does our face actually merge with the mirror? Is there merging? Do we see that contact? Is there a contact between our actual face and the mirror? You know, how does that happen? Can you locate that relationship? And can you trace where the past becomes the present and the present becomes the future? Or when dawn becomes daylight and daylight becomes dusk, can we say when that is? Do we even see that? Is that a direct experience for us? That exact moment. Here's a good one. Where do we end and our world begin? Can you trace that? Can you trace that one? For instance, you know, I'm speaking to you and looking at you. So in some sense, yeah, where do I begin, end, and you begin? It's an interesting questioning, isn't it? This in itself is a contemplation. I think this is a contemplation that is very valuable to do. It's magical in a way. I find this is a magical investigation because you see very clearly that nothing is negated, and yet it kind of breaks it all open. You know, so this could be something you could try at home, part of your Majjhimaka studies. Your personal Majjhimaka studies. Or you could do it when you meet as a group or whatever. There was a great scholar named Dharmakirti, Indian scholar in the 7th century, and he was one of the main founders of Buddhist epistemology and logic. And he said, "I have never seen a subject without an object." Subject and object are, you know, interdependent. The subject always arises in dependence upon each other. And this is how we experience life. But when we look closer, we might ask, well, where does a subject and object actually meet? Where do we have contact? When I look at you, it's not like you came into my eye or my eye consciousness came into you. How did that happen? How did that happen? We never actually perceive any contact between the knower and the known at all. And yet somehow perception takes place. Somehow we have an experience. So one of the ways to use this logic, not same, not different, is to examine the nature of cause and effect. And like I was saying, one of the traditional examples uses the seed and the fruit, or the seed and the sprout, sorry, the seed and a sprout. Like I was saying the other day, it drives people crazy sometimes because it gets extremely precise and nitpicky, but if you ever get a chance to study about seed and sprout, I really recommend it. And like Kiki was saying today earlier, it will drive you crazy. You were saying that yesterday, Phil. You'll feel agitation and irritation. Maybe those are the same thing.
It's annoying.
It's annoying. Yeah, there's something unsettling about it at times. And then, then there'll be big breakthroughs of amazement. You know, amazement. My friend Nick, he always says, there's no way to get through this. I told him I was going to write a middleweight book for, you know, how they have middle this and this for dummies, like Einstein for dummies or quantum physics for dummies. I said, I'm going to write a Majjhimaka book for dummies. He says, there's no way. He says, there's no way to break through this without just a little bit of counterintuitive head bashing. Yeah. So I'm not saying it's painful in the bad way, but it's like with your muscles, you know, like if you haven't worked out for a while, it's a little bit hard and you feel irritated. Once you get going and those endorphins kick in, you know, you like it. You can't wait to do it more. So this way, this is what I'm suggesting about this particular thing. And it gets more and more fascinating as you go. And your mind just naturally learns how to do it, you know? So I wanted to say a little bit about seed and sprout. You know, we usually see a seed, we think of a seed and a sprout in a linear sequence. Without investigation, it's a no-brainer. A sprout comes from a seed. You know, we depend on farmers to grow our food, and they depend on the nature of cause and effect. They know that sprouts come from seeds, and they plant accordingly, and they create the causes and conditions for food to grow. And if we were to say that a sprout didn't come from a seed, it would be incredibly obnoxious, because in fact we eat their food, you know. So we can all just simply say, in the context of ordinary life, that sprout comes from seed, and there's no problem with that. But if you check carefully, you will not see the connection between seed and sprout. We never actually observe a sprout coming from a seed. This must sound really radical for people who haven't heard this, but hear me out. My friend Andy, who studied my Jemaka, he said he did an experiment where he tried to watch a sprout come from a seed. This is the logic. At the time of the seed, there is no sprout. At the time of the seed, there is no seed. Thanks. I might need help, so just jump in. I get my mind also in language gets a little tripped up on this. Yeah. So at the time of the sprout, there is no seed. There might be, like, if you look, there's like a shell that the seed was in, but the sprout and the shell are separate by that point. So there's only the shell. So we never perceive an actual contact. We think the seed is a cause for routes, and undoubtedly this seems to happen. But in order for seed and sprout to have a relationship of cause and effect, the seed would have to make contact with the sprout somehow. They would have to meet, right? They would have to have a meeting point. So when does a seed leave its seedhood and become a sprout? We don't see that contact. So it's kind of like...
I love that word, seedhood.
Seedhood, oh, yeah, seedhood. Well, yeah, sometimes you have to make up your own language in this stuff because it's so non-conventional. So it's like when we look in a mirror, we don't see the face merge with the mirror, and yet the image appears in the same way. We don't see that. Now, sometimes it looks like the seed is there at the time of the sprout, and I don't know if you've ever, you know, when we were little, we used to plant those, have an avocado pit. I guess that's a seed. That can be considered a seed. And we put it in the water, it grows its roots, and then we see a sprout and the pit at the same time, like the sprout cracks open, and then the pit cracks open, and then the plant comes out the top and emerges. So we see two things at the same time. But this is problematic too, because if two things exist simultaneously at the same time, you can't really say they're cause and effect. They're two distinct things. So they don't share this relationship of cause and effect. It's a little bit like, you know, when a woman gets pregnant, the baby is in her womb. You wouldn't say, in some sense, because they're two separate entities. The mother is not really giving birth. The baby's just coming out of the mother. But the mother is not making the baby. They're already existing as separate. Do you know what I'm saying? They're already separate. So they're never really perceived as one thing. I mean, I certainly didn't perceive my baby as one thing. I would always say, he's kicking, I feel, da-da-da-da. You know, oh, there he is, oh, it's a boy, you know, kind of, whatever, you know. Actually, when my son came out, Rinpoche said, what is it? No, I said, what is it? You know, I couldn't see. He said, it's a baby. That's what Rinpoche said. I think he was so astounded by the whole process, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, so cute. Oh, my God. So... So with the avocado and the sprout, you know, you see them at the same time. So in other words, they're equal in being other from each other. For example, like we have this cup here and I have this pen here. These are just as other from each other as a seed or a sprout or a baby and a mom. They're distinct. So we don't say then that they have merged or separate. It's so interesting, isn't it? So it could be argued that although we don't see the contact between seed and sprout, there must be some kind of purpose or energy that shoots through that keeps things continued. You know, we might think that. Like it migrates from the seed to the sprout. But if the seed is already gone by the time of the sprout, how can it migrate? How can it contact? Like you might think it's like, you know, like beads on a mala. But in fact, the beads are very discrete, separate entities. If they were really together, they would merge, you know, but they don't. They're discrete entities on a string. You know, we think of continuum this way, but in fact, we never find anything meeting. Everything is completely made of parts, and so how can you say that it touches? And yet, it appears as discrete. Nothing collapses into one thing, but they're not separate either. They don't merge, nor do they separate.
What about two things that need each other to survive that could not survive?
Yeah, that's interdependence. Yeah.
They're still not the same.
They're not different. They still don't touch. Like, it's the same thing we've been talking about. We do need a seed for a sprout. It's the same as that example. I'm not saying that a sprout doesn't necessarily come from a seed in the way it appears, but I'm just saying there's no contact. We don't see relationship. We'll get to this. I know it's a very strange logic, but it's very strange too that when you look, you can't find it. That's what we're seeing, is that maybe the way we think about things is not how they are. This is all Majjhimaka keeps saying. You know, this is a very famous quote by Maitreya Buddha in the Lankavatara Sutra. Things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise. So, go figure. So even if the seed has a purpose, the seed is still gone at the time of the sprout, so that the purpose could have no direct connection with the sprout. So how could the seed transmit this purpose to the sprout? This comes in a lot of arguments and debates, especially in Chandrakirti's text, Madhyamakavatara. So based on this investigation, we cannot say the sprout and the seed are separate, or that they ever merge or make contact. But they most definitely share some kind of relationship and arise nevertheless. So again, it's not a denial of the nature of relationship. Relationship is just different than we assume it is. That it is not something we can point to or be traced. This arising cause and effect karma is apparent, yet it's empty. You know, I think this is so interesting because we look at, again, I was saying in this, I've been teaching a lot lately, so sometimes I can't remember where I said something, but I think I said here, we tend to look through a particular lens at things. So, for example, we look at something through the lens of true and untrue, but in fact, we can still function and be in the world and have tremendous connection to things without looking at whether something is true or not. I'm sure we do it all the time without noticing. But we tend, when we have a discussion like this, to think, well, is it true or untrue? Does it come together or does it separate? Is it one or is it two? You know? But perhaps it's just the way we're looking at things that makes it this feels so odd to us. Like, how can it be? How can it be that? You know, this does not run counter to the conventional or relative truth. We use the farmer's logic. We use the farmer's logic. An apple seed never becomes a banana tree. We can see that. You know, there's some sort of order of way things work. Appearance is not in question. There's no question that these function, and yet the flow or purpose or circumstance behind this, we can't find. But we can actually observe our experience, and when we do, we can't find this happening. So in the context of ordinary mind, this seems like, wow, it's magic. Like my teacher and some teachers say, oh, it just happens magically. Mm-hmm. But it's only magic in relation to ordinary mind. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it's just kind of how things are. Do you kind of see what I mean by that? That maybe we're just seeing it all wrong. And the way we see it, we think this is how things are, and we have a whole paradigm for seeing it in that way. But in fact, things are working very differently than how we think they are. So when we step out of our unexamined paradigm, we just see how things arise without our beliefs. Without our beliefs. Directly. So a relationship, we find, is quite different than we thought. So one way we often talk about the way things arise, like this magical quality, is that it's dreamlike. I'm sure those of you who have studied Madhyamaka constantly hear, like a dream, mm-hmm. like an echo, like a mirage, you know, like a rainbow. There's many analogies. There's a number of, like 16 analogies that are used in that way. So we experience phenomena as dreamlike when we realize phenomena is, this is a word that's often used, merely apparent. It's mere appearance. It's not really true. It's mere appearance. So things appear, but there's no realness to them. So like when we wake up from a dream, we realize, oh, there's no truth to it. And yet we were caught in a story. You know, something was chasing us and we were afraid. Or we were flying, and so it was so nice, you know. And we were enjoying that. So there's this functionality to art, the way we are in the world and being. When we're dreaming, we don't consider it to be real. We wake up and things are different. What we are talking about here is similar. It's functioning. We're experiencing it. There's no denial of that. It's just that it's not how we think it is, this kind of realness to it. And the way we interpret it, we have so much misunderstandings about the way that things are. You know, and this is questioning appearance and how things really are. So mere appearance, when we talk about mere appearance or how phenomena are like a dream, there's three points my teacher always points out. The first thing is everything arises interdependently as like a dream. So like a dream, our waking life arises due to interdependence or relationship. This is how we experience our world, just in the same way we experience our dream world, in a sense. The second thing is things are illusory, like a dream, and that we can't find a connection between a cause and effect. There's no true coming together or separating. And the third point is that things are insubstantial. When we try to find something that exists intrinsically, we can't. They're insubstantial, made of parts, can't find, no boundary, no perimeters. Somebody told me last night, parameters is the wrong word, it's perimeters. I didn't know that all these years. Please.
What was the first one?
The first one is that everything arises interdependently or in relationship, you can say, because that's the language we've been using. Everything is dependent is another way to say it. The second one is illusory, and the third is insubstantial. So that nothing comes together separates then, and yet things are vividly apparent and experienced, is what what is meant when they say in the Mahayana and Vajrayana that things are unborn. Mm-hmm. Unborn. How can they be born if there's no cause? They're unborn. In the Vajrayana, we often hear unborn awareness, or they're spontaneously present, meaning there's no causes and conditions, but they seem to just appear. It's important to see how the Vajrayana is connected to the emptiness teachings. So, I'm saying this. This all comes from the middle way view. We don't want to think that the Vajrayana has any different view, actually. There's a different skillful means, and it's more powerful. It's more expedient. But the view of emptiness is just the same. And without the view of emptiness, then, of course, there is no Vajrayana. So the skillful means are different. The language is different. And Madhyamaka is just a way to break apart conceptually all these beliefs that we have help us understand how things are. So His Holiness Dilgo Khenzo Rinpoche, one of my main teachers, the teacher of Khongtrul Rinpoche, he said, without some understanding of Madhyamaka, it's quite difficult to understand Mahamudra and Dzogchen. Mm-hmm. so we see how important this is. So I want to, having said all this, I want to, since yesterday we talked about eternalism, I thought it would balance it out to say something about nihilism. Nihilism is such a fascinating thing, experience. And it's a default position. When you're not in the middle way, you have eternalism and nihilism. Those are your choices. And all the views, is, I just recently heard Trungpa Rinpoche talking about this, fall into either one of those categories. So there's this concern here, because we have such a dualistic mind, thinking one way or the other all the time, that because nothing comes together or separates, it doesn't matter what we do. You know, cause and effect doesn't mean anything. So I wanted to just dispel this misunderstanding, because like with the arhats yesterday, the story of the arhats, they were really afraid about this. This is their biggest fear. If cause and effect are not true, see, they're having this idea of true, because we're not, Majjhimaka never refutes the functionality of cause and effect. It just negates that it's some there's some truth to it. So when they hear it's empty, you know, they had a heart attack and died. So the reason they had a heart attack and died, so to speak, probably they were just, you know, lost their breath for a minute, let's say. It's kind of nicer. but it was it's shocking to hear that kind of thing, perhaps, for people. This kind of spiritual crisis comes. So then the fear of nihilism, they fall into nihilism. You have a strong belief, and the belief is shattered. Where do you go? Nihilism. Meaninglessness, hopelessness, depression, doubt, all these kind of things arise. So, you know, this is not a rejection. And the hearts had a very big misunderstanding of what the Buddha was talking about when he said there's no cause and effect. And we, you know, are not telling a farmer that there is no seed and fruit because we eat the food he plants. But there are some interesting schools. The main school in the Indian tradition that they used to debate with, that the nihilist school, is called the Charvakas. They don't spend much time on it because the logic is so flimsy. But anyways, just look at it. Let's just look at this. But I think actually in our culture, watching people have struggle with nihilism, I think we have much more subtle and difficult things arise that are nihilistic. So the Charvakas say there's nothing beyond what you see. Perceptions are the truth, basically. People say that, perceptions are the truth. So they say in the text, peas are round. Nobody makes peas round. They're just like that. The peacock feathers, they're iridescent, but no one made it like that. That's just how it is. The sun rises in the morning. Nobody pushes it up. It just comes up naturally. It's a kind of a flimsy, in a way. It's like there's no order to the universe. It's just as it is. And there's kind of a denial of any, well, probably any kind of God or any kind of forces that makes it happen. So it's a kind of a denial of the basic farmer's logic, that there are causes and conditions that make things the way that they are, even just physically, biologically, or whatever. You know, it's in existentialism, you know, there's this sense, sometimes it almost sounds like Buddhism, because the existentialists are saying nothing has an intrinsic meaning to it. Just like in Majjhimaka, we say nothing is intrinsically existence. But here, meaning is not an idea or a truth. It's really an experience in Majjhimaka. When we talk about meaning, having meaning in our life, it's not a conceptual idea that we're holding on to. It's an experience. Let me give you an example. I have a friend. She's very tender-hearted. She's the one who makes the tankas. Very tender-hearted person. And she wrote me and she asked me this question. She says, sometimes I see someone squish a bug, and then I point out it's not compassionate, you know, to squish the bug. Maybe what is the point? Think of the bug, you know. And a friend will say, well, isn't everything empty? You know, I don't want, and she says, I don't want to sound like a fundamentalist, but what do I say to that? You know, so emptiness or the middle way doesn't really question relationship and experience. You know, being squished is an experience that's painful. You know, nobody would want to be squished. So it's not like a truth. It's just what we're experiencing. You see the difference? Like, we're always holding on, oh, this is the truth. Don't do it because this is right, this is wrong. But that's not the system we're operating from. When we talk about meaning in this tradition, we're actually talking about, you know, things are positive or negative by virtue of whether they cause harm or happiness. So meaning in this tradition, for example, when we're engaged in service, we feel so much meaning, not as a conceptual idea, but as we feel connected, we feel awake, we feel touched, you know, we feel joy, we feel compassion, as opposed to whatever we feel when we're doing something that causes harm. It's just how the human mind is, and this whole path is constructed on happiness for self and other, true happiness, deep happiness, experienced happiness. So that's what's meant by meaning in this situation. So, you know, existentialists kind of have this denial of anything intrinsic, but they're not also operating on this system of this level of meaning that we have in our tradition. So it has this nihilistic quality to it often. So our conduct here is deeply important, and we feel our world. Everything matters. You know, in this tradition, absolutely everything you do matters. You know, here we're saying there's no cause and effect actually operating, and at the same time, we're having the experience. We're functioning. Things are happening. And we notice that if we're kind to others, you know, what it does to our own mind. And when we're unkind to others, what it does to our own mind. So everything matters. As Padmasambhava says, you know, my view is as high as the sky, but my conduct is refined as like a barley flour, you know, sampa that they eat in Tibet, this very fine flour. So the way we respond in relationship brings so much meaning to our life, so much bodhicitta, so much kindness, so much joy to us. So when the nihilists deny cause and effect, they're really separating the two truths. Everything is empty. Therefore, you don't have to relate to the world around you. They deny relationship. They deny the meaningfulness of relationship. You know, everything is empty is really a negation or annihilation of experience. A no, you know, a big fat no, you know. So again, you know, we have to come back to our mantra, because things are in relationship, they are empty. Because things are empty, everything can arise. Water and ice, you know, as we've been talking about. Sometimes I find that nihilism can be very subtle. Like there's this kind of intellectual nihilism that I've been encountering a lot as I travel and I go to conferences. You know, for example, there's a lot of people have a different views of the teacher. Like we have a Vajrayana view. So the relationship with the teacher is very valuable to us. It's a practice. You know, it's a guru yoga as a practice. Mm-hmm. And it's a skillful means. Dzongtsar Khyentse Rinpoche says it's like the most difficult skillful means that there is. But it's a skillful means for awakening. So we have a certain understanding of relationship, but a lot of people have trouble with this notion of guru, because there's been a lot of really painful things, not just in our tradition, but in the Catholic Church and so forth, like abuse of authority and so on. So there's a lot of people have a very negative attitude sometimes toward the teacher, which is frustrating. I very much understand it, but I also feel very frustrated because I cherish this tradition and I know what it can be. And if understood well, this relationship can be very powerful for us, but that's another issue. There was this, I went to this one conference, and one of the teachers who has a kind of bitter attitude about the Vajrayana said, the purpose of the teacher is to become autonomous. So in other words, and I'll explain this because in a way it is, right? To stand on your own two feet. He said to be kind of be your own person. It's like we're kind of equal to them. They're our friends. They're just humans. They're very much like us. And I think that's fine. Of course they're humans. They're human beings and they go through different things and struggles and so forth. But if you look at the teacher as just ordinary, if you don't use the relationship in a different kind of way, then you'll just pick and choose what you want to be a teaching, and your ego will remain quite intact. There, hence the Vajrayana is very powerful in this way. So this person feels we're equal, and he puts that out there very strongly. And there's a sense that he doesn't really appreciate lineage very much and has a very strong ego, this person. I also like this person in a certain way. He's a provocative teacher. But so
did you challenge him?
I have, but I haven't been in a situation where I've had enough time, but I would like to.
I mean, in a friendly way.
I would like to know this person better because he's been helpful for me in his tendency toward nihilism. Mm-hmm. I've learned a lot from him, and he's very bright. So he's not going to be easy for me to challenge. He's a scholar. I better not say too much or you'll know who I'm talking about. No. Anyways, a lovely man. But just, this is, I saw something in this conversation. So he said this out loud in a conference. And so, okay, so the purpose of the teacher is to become autonomous. And I thought, well, I mean, in one way, we are, our teacher wants us to stand on our own two feet. Our mother wants us to stand on our own two feet. We want our kids to stand on their own two feet. And, you know, we also know that our nature is inseparable from the nature of the teacher. It's not like in nature the teacher is, you know, this big, grand, enlightened presence, and we're separate from that. Hence, we have our particular kind of path that's not theistic. And yet, we don't forget the kindness of our mother. We don't forget the kindness of our lineage. We know where the wisdom comes from. Like there's this denial of relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Phil.
Elizabeth, isn't this, it sounds a bit like you're describing the teacher-student relationship. Sounds a bit like the logic of the seed and the sprout. That sort of leads to the next. If that may not be quite the way to say it. But, you know, if the student did not have the teacher, where would we be?
Yeah, where would we be? Yeah. Where would we be? I don't think I'd be anywhere. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to think what would have happened if you hadn't met your teacher. I can't even imagine, really. It's been such an important relationship for growth and understanding. So I know I wouldn't be here.
Yeah. It's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I find, this is a nihilist view because it's a denial of relationship. It's a denial of, there's no appreciation of where you come from. You think you have all this knowledge from you, like it's yours. There's a lack of humility there. And you find this a lot in the scholarly Buddhism. And some of the new Buddhism that I'm encountering as I go to different conferences and just listen to people speak. It's so me-oriented. There's so no appreciation. It's very painful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the back. Okay. See you so well.
My name's Amy.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. Thank you for this. I've been experiencing this feeling that things are kind of unclear and uncertain in my future in particular, and feeling it's okay, kind of resting there, and not really stressing out about it or thinking about it. And also feeling like increasingly uncertain about things, and yet underneath that there's this kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but I guess feeling okay about not needing the certainty. And I read this really moving thing in the, there's a Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, they have a newsletter, and I was reading it the other night and I thought of you, this was maybe a week ago before you came, there was a story about this farmer in Maine who's a biodynamic farmer. So she practices, you know, these sometimes strange practices that Rudolf Steiner has.
Yeah.
One of them is you put this stuff in a cow horn and you bury it in a compost pile.
Uh-huh.
And it was so moving the way she talked about it, because she said, you know, how do I know? Do I really know that this is going to help my farm? I actually don't really know this. But it's a gesture. She said, I do so much harvesting It's just a gesture for me. It's a gesture of gratitude. And I just thought that was a great word. That
yeah, gesture is a great word.
Trusting the uncertainty, that's like a gesture, you know. And she talked about how she felt really connected to all these different things on the farm and how those relationships, she just felt that she was somehow giving something back when she put this cow horn in the compost pile.
Right.
That made it feel like, however, whether or not she could believe it, it was the right thing to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was just really very beautiful.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you're talking about with feeling connected and not needing belief or doubt.
Exactly.
You know, experiencing both belief and doubt. Of course, she believes in it or she wouldn't do it. But she doubts it, but she just goes forward and it's a gesture. And I just thought that
that's
that
a beautiful
was,
example.
I thought that's how I hope I can be as well, just with my
practice.
Like just do these things that maybe don't make sense to me that a teacher suggests I do or that I think I should do. And not really have no idea like about the six realms or even about karma. It's like, well, maybe, but I don't. Maybe I better not think too hard about it. Why don't I just go forward here?
Yeah, you know, what you were saying earlier, too, saying where your life is kind of in this uncertain place, it sounds like something's brewing.
Yeah.
And that's what I would say about the realms. Just let it brew.
Yeah.
And you never have to believe or disbelieve it.
Yeah.
There
that's
will never come a time. Mm-hmm. Actually, in the end, you'll see that's absolutely not where you are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I never felt challenged by that. I know a lot of people have and sometimes do, but certain other things challenge and you just let it brew.
Yeah.
Just let it work on you. Mm-hmm. You know, let it work on you. The most provocative things are so interesting. I'll tell you a story too then, since you said one. I'll return with a story because I liked your story so much. But I was teaching my Jamaka at Sokni Rinpoche's Dzogchen seminar last in the summer. And we had a wild time. Rinpoche was there the whole time while I was teaching on his throne. And it was a full tent, and people were very passionate. We had a great time. And we talked a lot about the unity of the relative and absolute, you know, bringing them together, not separating them, but bringing them together. And the students were getting it, and they were getting very jazzed up because they're very long-time Vajrayana practitioners who most of them had no understanding, actually. Or they might have had an understanding of emptiness, but they had no Madhyamaka training.
Mm.
And they just got it really well. And then after, at the end, Sonia Rinpoche's great. So he was quiet, and I think he enjoyed it. He had fun, too. And then at the end, he said something which completely separated the two truths. Like, he separated relative and absolute bodhicitta by saying something like, yeah, but, you know, because we were saying, the more you give, the more you move into emptiness. But he was saying, I hate when people are thinking like that. You should just think of the other person and give to them, because if you're so motivated for yourself to be free. But of course, in the teachings, it says this is to benefit self and other. And it works that way. The more open you are, you know, the more you're able to give. And the more you give, the more you open. Anyways, the students got a little flipped out by his comment because they just finally felt they got something, and boom, Sokni Rinpoche, like, completely. So after the teachings, and I was a little startled at first, too. I'm like, wow, we did all this work, all this 2 weeks, and then Rinpoche just separated the two truths. And but then I just let it brew, like I'm saying, let it brew. And then it started to touch me a little, what he was saying, just to completely give yourself over. Of course, once you do feel like your mind is freeing up. What can you do? But so the students, a lot of the students came to me and kind of complained about Sokni Rinpoche. I mean, it's very sweetly. They love him. They have a kind of the feisty relationship with Sokni Rinpoche, and he's feisty with them, so it's all in good humor. But they were saying, do you think that's true? Why did he say that? And what do I do with that, you know? And I said, like, first of all, it's challenging their sense of having and holding and finding and all of that. And I was thinking, well, you know, you put yourself in the position with a guru, and they challenge all your rightness. You could just be so right about, you know, even understanding the unity of the two truths or emptiness, you know. And the teacher will always challenge that, you know. So you have to, when something like that happens, the hell realms are, right, wrong, yes, no. You don't have, just let it work on you. Let it eat up your ego. Let it brew, you know? This is the beauty of this relationship with the teacher. I point to the shrine, this relationship, you know, is that it's not always fair. It doesn't always make sense, you know? You don't always understand it. The Dharma challenges you. The teacher challenges you. Just let it brew. Open question. Mind of an open question. Yay. Yeah, I love the mind of an open question. So that, to get back, where was I? Anyways, yeah, this idea of the mother. Like, you always appreciate where it came from. You always appreciate your mother. You wouldn't be where you were if your mother, if it weren't for your mother or your teacher or what have you. That's a form, this form of nihilism, I call it intellectual nihilism. It's like you think it's you should have written the Bodhisattva Acharya Avatara. Or you'll write the next one, you know? Like, it's just...
The tenth chapter.
Yeah. No, there's a tenth chapter. That's the dedication. The 11th chapter. So even from an absolute point of view, we can never really see how the wisdom of the teacher even comes into the student's mind, right? It's the same principles we've been talking about. Do you see? Does the teacher literally pour the wisdom into the brain of the student? And, you know, it doesn't happen that way. But it doesn't mean we don't know where the wisdom came from. We know very well, you know. And to know it means to be part of the lineage and to be humble in the face of the lineage and be a good, to be a receptive disciple for the teachings. My teacher said in his book, a light comes through. Nobody questions where a child comes. The child comes from the womb of the mother. You know, the child comes from the womb of the mother. So in relationship, we do. This is what makes our life so meaningful. Being in relationship, we experience so much love and compassion. And this can only increase with the understanding of the middle way. The more we understand the middle way, the more love and compassion is released in our own awareness. It's through relationship that we wake up. We utilize the world through relationship. We understand emptiness through relationship. So this is why this has so much to do with that. And, you know, it's interesting because I think about the teacher and then separate and not separate with my teacher, and I've thought about it a lot, and he would always come and go, and of course I have a very close relationship with my teacher, and we've gone through many things and grew up together and so forth, but you know, I always had this feeling like, what does it really mean to meet the teacher or be with the teacher? Because a lot of times I'd be with him and I'd feel very distant, like I was saying, and a lot of times we'd be far apart and I'd feel close and so on. But I think I came to realize at some point that when I was really practicing and I was really engaged in my practice, that's when I really met the teacher, in the emptiness, in the Dharmakaya, in the, you know, in that experience of being in sane relationship. So this is where we find a way of being that is not about being separate or one. And this is a profound experience of the teacher. And there's this very profound, I don't know if you do you do the Narak Gangshar prayer? It's one prayer, I think it's more of a Nyingma purification prayer or confession. It's a confession that we do. And it says in there, and this is very beautiful, when awareness wisdom is devoid of permanence and interruption, how tiring to regard it as the duality of perceiver and perceived. How deluded to view it as permanence and interruption. I apologize for this in the expanse of awareness wisdom space. So when we say a permanence and interruption, we mean coming together and separating, you know? So I apologize for not seeing this, that there's none of this, and I apologize. You know, this is a Vajrayana level confession. It's very, very touching, one of my favorite practices. So permanence and interruption means that we come together as one, And then we disperse as two separate things. When we die, we separate. This is how we experience relationship in a gross way. But if our mind is resting in the middle way, we understand we're always in relationship. We're an infinite relationship with our world. And so, you know, we always hear stories of His Holiness the Karmapa, the previous Karmapa. You know, when he says, when you die, nothing happens. Mm-hmm. Nothing happens. There's no coming together, separated. He was resting in the nature of emptiness all along. He was never separated from infinite relationship. Therefore, and there's no separate he and anything to be in relationship with. There's only this kind of mere appearance, this experience of being in relationship, but with no intrinsicness or realness to it. So there's no fear of loss. There's no fear of separation. This is how we want to die. You know, this is how we hope we're going to die. In the end, that we understand this, that we find the middle way, that we rest in the middle way. I saw an email when Tengu Rinpoche passed away. Lama Rinchen sent out this email that says, if anyone asks what we, students of Rinpoche, should do now, the answer is simple. We decide whether the Lama has left us or not. So we remember this. And I remember when Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche died and Khongtrul Rinpoche, who grew up at his feet, and how he just went and did his practice. I was always afraid for that day. Mm-hmm. It was a very big loss for all of us, but it was like his father or his, grandfather, really like mm-hmm. his father. And yet there was no hysterics whatsoever. It was just like, go and meet your teacher now. So this is really encouragement to go find, realize emptiness, to understand what this all means, because this is a resting place for the practitioner, the go-to mm-hmm. place. This is where we need to abide. The dude abides. We need to abide there. Whatever. I don't know, it came up because we've been talking about the Big Lebowski for like 2 days.
You remember in the Lebowski, there's a scene about the nihilist?
You were just like, saying, say it again.
I can't remember exactly, they were really affronted by the nihilists. Like the big guy, John Goodman, said, nihilist, we got to beat him up or something.
No, he says, wait, you said this story. He remembers, didn't you say, like, that looks really hard? No, well, Eric said
Eric knows it perfectly. The nihilist is in the pool, and the dude walks by and says, huh, like, who's that? And then what does he say?
Somebody tells him that's so-and-so, he's a nihilist. The dude says, oh, that looks exhausting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what you were just saying.
He's
that, right?
Lying in the pool with an empty fifth of vodka.
Oh, yeah. That's funny. Anyway, one of those. So anyways, I just wanted to question with you, what does it mean to be in relationship? Good to think about. This is an important question of these teachings, because when we understand the true nature of relationship, then we find that we don't have to come together or separate. And this is, I think, what my teacher was trying to tell me when he just simply went like this, and how long has it taken me to figure this out? Because this is a lot of my own personal exploration as well as what I've studied, just trying to figure this out, It takes a lot of work, but very interesting work in contemplation. So I do, I hope you are interested in and pursue it a little bit. And if not, just take a few of these exercises and think about it sometimes, because it has a very powerful effect on the mind. So I'm ready for if anybody has any anything to say or stories, questions. Phil, you have something?
I was curious about the Magalmaka logic seemed, at least the way you're presenting it, seemed to be focused on looking at objects in terms of the relationships of objects. And I wonder if you could talk about the relationship we have with our thoughts in terms of looking into awareness and thoughts.
And
does the Madhyamaka logics, do they address that? if you could say.
Yeah, most certainly. Well, when we talk about, generally the Majjhimaka logic looks into the five skandhas. So we have forms, mm-hmm. then we have the feelings, which is the what we consider internal mm-hmm. experiences, or also physical sensations. Then we look at, I like to call the third one discernment, like how we decide what something is or the value of something. You know, maybe some judgments or labels about what we experience, dividing things, lumping things in that way. Then the fourth is the mental formations, the way it's sometimes called impulse, like how we react or respond to certain situations. And then the consciousness, so just the knowing aspect. They say consciousness is like a camera in a bank. It's just knowing things dualistically, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of self and other, but it's knowing. Mm-hmm. So we do, Majjhimaka does, in the texts, examine all these very carefully and clearly. Like in the Shantideva's ninth chapter, there's a lot that they examine mindfulness of these experiences. In the Mahamudra tradition or the Dzogchen tradition, of course, the teacher is pointing you directly at your own mind and asking you to try to find it. Mm-hmm. It's very similar, but the Vajrayana tradition is more direct, and there's transmission involved. But I find it very valuable to ground yourself in this, to understand the logic of emptiness too. And then that also will be more profound, I think. So does that answer? Is that, am I, this response helpful? Or yeah. You can also probe if mm-hmm. I don't get it too. I see a hand in the back. Hi.
There's nothing intrinsic in the human being. The Buddha nature is not intrinsic. But if all beings have Buddha nature, has there ever been a being without Buddha nature?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting question. Well, you know, you can talk about Buddha nature like this. This is a relationship. The sky and clouds. So the sky doesn't create anything. Space doesn't create anything, nor does it destroy anything. It's just, it has a quality of being yielding. So space is not a dependent thing. We say it's like not a changeable. It's the one phenomena we, like Longchenpa says, it's the universal metaphor for, you know, like emptiness. It has a changeless nature. The clouds and stuff that proliferate in the space are dependent on space. Like nothing could arise, like we've been saying. Nothing could arise if there was no space. Without emptiness, nothing could arise. Everything would be inert. It couldn't move. So, you know, the phenomenal experiences, they say, the changing, everything that's changing and moving and relational, all the relative truths, are what they say, adventitious. They're temporary. They're because they're based on causes and conditions. So they're always in movement. So things arise and they kind of express themselves and then they dissolve. But the space remains the same. So we're talking here about the views are, we talked last night about views a lot. Views are extra, extraneous to the nature. So what happens when the contrivances of the mind, all these misunderstandings, dissolve? When we say misunderstandings, again, we're not just talking about philosophical misunderstandings or ideas. We talked about beliefs last night. Just a belief can be anything. It could be just even non-conceptual, like just the sense of that there's a self and another. Remember? So when the misunderstandings we have about the way things appear dissolve, then we just rest in this there's a naturalness. That's why when you look at the teachers, there's not all the struggle with the phenomena. Because there's no sense of realness there, and believing, and wanting, and not wanting, and all. There's a sense of relaxation and understanding. It's like these are all like the clouds proliferating and dissolving, moving, you know. We're not fooled by them. So you can say like the Buddha nature is likened to space in that particular way. But space, of course, we don't talk about it as having awareness. Now that's very, that kind of knowing quality to it. Does that make sense?
In some ways, yes. But
yeah.
You need the knowing quality, or otherwise it's nihilism.
Yeah, no. And that's what we'd say is the mind is knowing. Awareness. And it has... Then when we get into the Buddha nature teachings, there are qualities of compassion and kind... what do they say? Wisdom, compassion, and skillful means. Power is the word that they use in the Uttara Tantra Shastra. Then you start getting into those, but they're not... They arise effortlessly without dualism. And this is a whole logic around this. There's a whole logic about what you're asking in the Uttara Tantra Shastra, which I'm sure, the Trungarumshi, I'm sure he teaches that. Then you learn what this means. Because you could say it's inherent in all beings, like which is like saying intrinsic, but not as a thing. It's not a thing. Mm-hmm. It's the nature of emptiness itself.
I think it's the indivisibility between emptiness and awareness.
Yeah.
It can't be separated.
Yeah. That's not talked about as much in this tradition. That's talked about more as you graduate to the Buddha nature teachings. And you might have heard the terms Rongtong and Shentong a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking from a more Rongtong point of view, which is the emptiness nature is emphasized. And in this tradition, there's a tendency not to want to say what it is, but just you do the contemplations and you rest in not finding. In the Zhentong schools, or particularly the Buddha nature, the Uttara Tantra, the third turning teachings, there is more emphasis on the qualities that arise, and they actually say them out loud. Mm-hmm. So they say that the teachings of the second turning work against eternalism, whereas the teachings of the third turning adjust against nihilism. And people get into big fights and debates about which one is better, but in fact, they both have their place. And the great teachers that I've known, and I'm sure it's the same with Trungrumshe and Kongtrumshe and the great Mipham Rumshe, the previous Mipham Rumshe, they all say there's no conflict between these two. It's just a different angle of looking at it. I just think this tradition is so far out. Because you just look and you can't find it, and then you rest there. And that you rest there doesn't mean you're in some blank state. That you rest there just means you don't want to say it, because the minute you say it, it becomes a belief. Yeah, it's just a method. It's just a method. But some people still won't get it. Therefore, we need third turning teachings, Shentong. And you go back and forth, you study them all. You study them all. Each in their own context, you appreciate them and know their place. And in the end, they're just as ideas, they're just views anyways. So you have to let go of them, like Sokni Rinpoche was suggesting when he totally put a wrench in our kind of comfortable conclusion. And even though it was an amazing conclusion, you can't hold on to that either. So... Yeah, in the back.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for these teachings and the ones in Ellsworth. I found them so very helpful. Thank you so much
for
coming.
I've just
these many times. I was thinking about something you said Monday night. It's been sort of percolating in my mind about open questions of, not an open mind is not right and not wrong. And you said something about it makes us completely protected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of all the samsaric ways we try to protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there are dharmic ways of mind protection, but I just wondered if you could say a little more about that.
Yeah, well, it protects us from nihilism and eternalism. Because when you are asking a question, you haven't reached a conclusion. There's not a sense of rightness that you know what something is. And because life doesn't lend itself to being known in a determinate way, then you say you're protected from that.
Okay.
And then you're protected from, doubt. Or because you haven't... Well, that also in itself is a conclusion. But you keep, you're not also lost in that because you're completely engaged. Like when you ask an open question, you're engaged with the phenomenal world. You're still in relationship, you know? So you're in relationship, but you're completely open. So it's like we were saying with Terry Gross, you know? She just moves to the next question, and she opens it up some more, and she moves. So it's not a passive, you know? It's not fundamentalism, but it's not passive either, like dull or spaced out, that you're right there with it, opening it up more and more. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's how it's a protection. Mm-hmm. So funny how we think of protections.
Yes.
Because this is not the resting in uncertainty is not, but it's not really uncertainty. I think this is what we're talking about is faith in a certain kind of way. Because the world can't be known in a determinate way, but we have found a place of rest there. Mm-hmm. We can stew in it. And actually it feels nice because we know things are continuously opening up. You know, and there's nothing scarier than holding on tightly in your life when things are going to change. What could be a more nightmarish scenario? But we think that's protection. And that. So all these logics, isn't it true that we hold the most absurd logic? Yeah.
So this
Amy.
Is reminding me about this Logon slogan I've never understood. Something like, I don't remember exactly, but it's something like seeing confusion as the
Kind of
the unsurpassable protection of emptiness.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, do I have to comment on that right now? I have to look at the comment here. I can't remember that one so well. What is it? I know. I mean, I've heard
translations.
It.
Translations.
Yeah.
Seeing delusive. Seeing experience as delusive. What she said was good.
Yeah. We say it again.
I don't remember how many kayas it is.
Four.
Three or four. Four.
That's right.
Oh yeah.
I think it's just right the way
saying.
You said it.
Yeah, it's kind of what I'm. It's kind of what I'm saying.
I know.
Seeing things as empty is a protection.
Does the confusion our own normal way of seeing things?
Yeah, confusion is our normal way of seeing things. Dualism, dualistically, with a sense of realness and intrinsicness. This is how we see. And then, therefore, we're wanting, not wanting. Our mind is full of preferences. And so, and then yet we live in this world that's moving and changing and full and not stable in the way that we think it is. So we set ourselves up for all this kind of confusion. And so, therefore, we don't find freedom in that, but always trying to rearrange the world according to our preferences. You know what I mean?
Emptiness gives us true protection.
In this way, emptiness gives us true protection. Like, again, Talopa said to Naropa, it's not the appearances that bind you, but it's your clinging and grasping. So basically that's saying, don't cling and grasp. Then you'll be protected because clinging and grasping is a sure setup for disappointment. Mm-hmm. Life doesn't lend itself to that kind of thinking. It's not stable. It's not static. And again, we think, oh, you know, uncertain or unpredictable is a problem. That's not a problem. It's only a problem for the mind that is fixed on something particular happening, right? This is where, that's samsara. That's all samsara is our own clinging and grasping. It's not like samsara is outside of ourself. So seeing confusion is the four kayas as unsurpassable shunyata protection. Yeah. I haven't thought of that one for a long time, but I'm sure that's what it means. I mean, emptiness is a great protection. You know, they say it's like shooting an arrow through space. It can't harm in space. Space cannot be harmed, you know. So like that. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
I was wondering if you could comment on, I was reading in the sixth chapter of the Dakini Power book.
Oh.
About you.
Oh. Yeah.
And your teacher, his first instruction to you for meditation was don't create. Mm-hmm. And I was very struck by that, reading it, and struck by your response, and wondered if you could comment on that and how your thinking has changed.
Yeah.
Over
yeah.
3 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was one of the first teachings. It's very true. Mm-hmm. And it was hard for me because, in fact, I come from a family where creativity is very valued, like an artistic, like creative family, like writers and musician people in my family. And so when Rinpoche said, yeah, stop creating, it really took me aback for a minute. It startled me or something. But what he talks about, another word that he used a lot, and I think it's a synonym for that, is naturalness, be natural. What does that mean to be natural? So when we talk about what's not natural or what he means by creating in that way is not seeing things directly, but getting caught in beliefs of eternalism and nihilism, in fact. Mm-hmm. Not really seeing how things are and how things work and labeling things and getting caught in ideas. And so when we're meditating, too, the mind is always creating. It's getting lost in thought. It's bracing itself against. There's all kinds of things going on, and we're not really just letting it be the way it is. So, therefore, I struggled with that at some. But his terms, I think, because he's my teacher, work best for me. And the terms that continuously come up for me in my life 30 years later are naturalness. Mm-hmm. Naturalness is one of the biggest ones. It's like a good reference word for what practice is, to just be a natural human being without all this fuss, mm-hmm. you know?
Yes.
Is that helpful?
Yes.
Okay, good.
I think it's a little similar. Again, thank you for being here. This has been really helpful tonight. It just sort of has felt like I couldn't articulate it, but that the essence of something has sort of gelled or come together.
Oh, wonderful.
I appreciate that a lot. I've been thinking about working with expectations and thinking that if I could keep from having them, then I either wouldn't be disappointed or I would be open to what I would find or get.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've discovered is that it appears as though there's no way to not have. And by not acknowledging them, they just are underground. And so then I get there, whatever it is, thinking I had no expectations and I was open. And then I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have any
expectations. Yeah.
I was open. Yeah. I thought that is too
convoluted. Yeah.
So from a practical,
that's funny.
Not having them isn't the way to work. Okay, I got that
part. Not having expectations.
Yeah, because it can't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't make it happen. I thought I was, but I was just denying it, I guess.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you would have, maybe you'd have something else that comes from the question, but I think my question is, do you have a way of, how would you respond to that? What would be the middle way? Or what would be, I guess, because that's what it is. Okay, I'm not going to have any, or I'm going to have these that aren't possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so funny because, like, for 2 days, we've been talking. We knew it was going to be warm today because we read it on the weather station. So we've been saying Thursday's, is today Thursday? No, Wednesday. So Wednesday's going to be our perfect day. We've been saying that. So we had a lot of expectations. So we had this whole kind of agenda that we were going to follow today because it was our perfect day. And we all kind of felt a little bit funny about saying perfect day because you know you're setting yourself up for expectations.
Yeah.
And really, yeah. but actually, the weather was good. That one came through.
Oh.
Anyway, so one of the things we were going to do today was go swimming. So we went to the pool. We're all ready to go. And the lady said the pool's closed. Why? Because somebody had an accident in the pool. So we couldn't swim in that pool, you know. So we've been making jokes all day about the perfect day, you know. And there's a reason I'm telling you this. Oh, yeah. But what we decided beforehand was if we can allow anything to happen, that will be the only real way to have a perfect day, you know. So we say you see everything as like a, I don't know, you know how they say in our lineage, see everything as the guru, see everything as the teacher, you know, like appreciate everything. So whatever even mishaps come, you can appreciate it. You know, that's the spirit of this. very much the spirit of the Vajrayana. Like we were saying, we were talking about a prayer of Yeshe Sogyal, where she's up on a mountaintop, it's freezing, she's naked, she's doing these practices, and all these kind of thoughts are tormenting her, and she's having hallucinations, and, you know, it's really tough. And the air is blowing, the wind is blowing against her skin, so she's wounded, and pus is coming out, and it's a big drama. Mm. And her whole thing is, she says, first she has a hard time, and then she realizes, this is my guru's mind, which in other words means, I'm going to take this as like rich, you know? And she says, I pray that he will send me more and more. Or we heard a translation, stir it up, you know. The other day, this Lama Willa, she did a translation of it. And in the end, instead of saying, I pray that you will send me more, he will send me more and more, Yeshe Sogyal is saying, stir it up. Because at some point, you have to be just interested in your life and experience that comes to you. And like, so that's the spirit. You know what I mean? You get that, what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a spirit we have to have in our practice. It's like, use it all. Don't waste it, you know? Yeah. That's the best way to deal with misfortune. So we actually had a perfect day.
So is that living in the middle way?
I think that's it. The attitude to have. Yeah. It's because then you stop rejecting and grasping. That's the approach of not grasping and rejection. So that's the middle way. So then it's just like everything is ritual. I'll tell this one more story, okay? It's just a funny story. But, so I just told this the other day, sweetie. You have to hear it again. So my friend Ram Jyoti lives in Florida. And so I go teach in Florida every year. And we have a sangha there, actually. So my friend Ram Jyoti has a Volvo that's really noisy. It makes a lot of sound. So when she picked me up from the airport last year, I said, Ram Jyoti, how are you? You know, as we were driving away from the airport, and it's all, you can hardly hear. And I heard her say, life's a bitch. So I thought it was funny because Ram Jyoti doesn't usually, she's very positive. And I thought, it doesn't sound like something she'd say. So I thought about it, and I thought, well, yeah, I said, yeah, maybe life is kind of a bitch sometimes. And then she said, no, I didn't say that. She said, I said, life is rich. So it depends how you take it. It will depend. It's up to you, as my teacher says. It's up to you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's a good time to close up. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'll recite the long life prayers and dedication, the last two pages of the book. This pure realm, surrounded by snow mountains, is the source of complete happiness and benefit. Avalokiteshvara, Tenzin Jamso, may you stand firm until the end of existence. Unborn, eternal, self-arising Dharmakaya, arises as the miraculous kayas of form. May the three secrets of the Karmapa be stable in the rush of nature, and may his limitless Buddha activity spontaneously blaze.
Splendor of teachings, Karma Lodro,
may you remain steadfast.
Your qualities of the glorious and excellent Dharma increase to infinite space. May your lotus feet always be stable, and may your Buddha activity of teaching and practice blaze victoriously in all directions. By this merit may all obtain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free.
Thank you very, very much. enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. It is my honor to thank you on behalf of everybody here, Advisory Committee of Portland and Advisory Committee of Down East. We're so glad you guys came down. Elizabeth, your enthusiasm for the middle way is absolutely infectious.
Good. I came here to spread my infection.
I think I caught it.
That's good. I'm happy, Kiki.
We did catch it because we've been studying the middle way thanks to your enthusiasm for probably almost 2 years.
So fabulous.
And it is is exhausting being a nihilist, and it's exhausting being an eternalist. Mm-hmm. And what's been so helpful, apart from your example and your enthusiasm, is your encouragement to us to be open to our experience, mm-hmm. To be open to not knowing, mm-hmm. and to be open to questions, mm-hmm. continuing questions, and what comes from that. But it's we've absolutely loved it. Everyone has said that. Mm. Absolutely loved it. Mm. So helpful.
I'm so happy.
So thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Rebecca, thank you for being a lovely attendant.
Yeah. Thank you.
So we have some gifts we'd like to give you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Oh,
thank you.
This is from us.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Oh. Thank you. Wow. Okay. Thank you very much.